This is Pamela Kuhn coming to you from Hollywood at the Turner Classic Movie Film Festival. This festival is in its 15th year, and there is no shortage of ardent fans and celebrity supporters in this testament to the classic film. You know, when I was a young girl, I spent many hours with my mother watching classic film, developing a love for the art of black and white cinematography and a devotion to the celebration of the musical, and discovering, even during my young years, the fascination of the allure that film noir held for me. For my mother and I, it was a bonding experience, especially as she had a short career in Hollywood as a singer and dancer. There is no doubt in my mind that my choice of career as a performer was influenced by a lifetime of watching classic film. And thanks to the many film giants like Steven Spielberg and Martin Scorsese, classic film is revered and now restored. Through clever programming by Turner Classic Movies with experts presenting in their genres, the longevity continues. This year, the festival boasts the help of filmmakers and actors such as David Fincher, Jodie Foster, Alexander Payne, Steven Spielberg, John Travolta, Nancy Myers, and many, many more, as they present films that have changed their lives and enriched their own artistic work. And of course, silent films have a special place at the festival. This year, there is a special presentation of how the Vitaphone formed a transition from silent to talkies in film history. Behind this all is the man who helms TCM. Ben Mankiewicz comes from film royalty in the lineage of a family that includes Herman and Joseph Mankiewicz, two of the most prolific film visionaries of their time. And yet, I am astounded each time that I have attended Turner Classic Movie Film Festival, that Ben Mankiewicz and his team of presenters are approachable and ready to personally discuss film with the many fans who attend, whether on the TCM cruise or in Hollywood. So it is with pleasure today that I introduce to you my first interview from the festival. And watch for my own personal vlogs on social media and further interviews from presenters, filmmakers, and actors from the world of Hollywood. So sit back and enjoy my conversation with filmmaker Shane Fleming. This is Pamela Kuhn, and the curtain is up on Center Stage, the show about the arts and the artists behind their work. I am thrilled to be reporting with Turner Classic Movie Film Festival Stories. One outstanding aspect of TCM is their devotion to the legacy of the era of silent film. In reality, no film was ever really silent. There was always music in the form of a pianist, small ensemble, full orchestras, and even in 1927, legendary violinist Fritz Kreisler was asked to appear for 1 week for the sum of $12,000. In fact, many times, the importance of the music outweighed the quality of the films. Historically, in sophisticated larger theaters, crowds came for the outstanding orchestral performances of romantic classical music accompanying the latest D.W. Griffith film. But movies were revolutionized in the 1920s with a development integrating and synchronizing sound onto disc to accompany silent film. There were several processes developed at the time, but I'm talking today about the Vitaphone, developed by Warner Brothers and Western Electric. With the advent of the Vitaphone, live musicians lost their movie theater jobs to recorded sound. In fact, from 1928 to 1930, 10,000 musicians literally lost their day job. Today, I have with me an expert who will be leading a presentation on the legacy of the Vitaphone at the 15th Turner Classic Movie Film Festival. Filmmaker Shane Fleming is an essential presenter of That's Vitaphone, The Return of the Sound on Discs, which is being shown on April 19th. He will be joined by special guests Bruce Goldstein, founder of Rialto Pictures, and Bob Weitz and Steve Levy, both part of the Warner Brothers sound engineering and post-production team. Shane Fleming himself is a film historian, film director, and actor. He is known for his film shorts, The Brothers Clifton, Boogie Woogie, and Miles at the Movies. And he is an integral part of Silence, Please on TCM. Well, Shane Fleming, welcome to Center Stage. It is such an
honor.
Thank
you very much. I feel very welcome. Thank you. That was a wonderful introduction.
Well, I aim to please, my dear. And I must say right from the beginning, my first sight of you was observing a beautiful video of you as a guest on TCM when you were 10 years old with the late Robert Osborne. Mm-hmm. Shane, I've got to say, in all of the shorts you have filmed, I sense a beautiful whimsy and a cherishing of melancholy and remembrance in everything you do. And when you were 10 years old and sitting on the sofa with Robert Osborne, I swear you were 10 years old going on 40. Your devotion to things old and the things that you wanted to cherish in films was so profound. What a journey you've had, Shane. You're doing so well. Bravo.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I cherish all those memories back. It's pretty astonishing that it was 10 years ago now. I'm now 20, so that's 50% of my whole time on this planet. So it's pretty mind-boggling to think it started all the way back then, but it was a real treat being able to have that experience.
You had such bravado when you were sitting there with the man, Robert Osborne. I mean, he was so lovely and he was so welcoming, but he treated you like an adult.
Yeah, that's what I was. I admired him so much for, because, you know, growing up, you know, I probably started to really delve into silent films and film history probably around the age of 6 or 7. And as I was getting a little bit older, luckily, I grew up in Manhattan, and there's a lot of great resources in New York for seeing these films in theaters. So by the time I was 8 or 9, I was regularly going to Film Forum on Houston Street, which was actually programmed by Bruce Goldstein, who will be co-presenting the presentation with me. And his programming at Film Forum really grew my education of seeing films. And I was able to meet people and see all these great films. And when you're a little kid, people will often give you a bit patronizing. And that was always a bit frustrating as a little guy, because I had studied and I knew all these facts, and people would treat me like a kid because, you know, I was. It's not an entirely unfair thing. But Robert was really, he did treat me like an adult. It was really sweet. And he also loved these films. And it was such a privilege. He had met everybody. He had so many great stories. He was such a gentleman.
Oh, yes, indeed. There was something about him. We all wanted him to be our grandfather. But at the same time, his knowledge and his beautiful welcoming of all of us into that world. And Shane, for you, you were talking about Modern Times with Charlie Chaplin. And I thought it was so extraordinary that as a child, you were sitting there very deftly saying, "Oh, none of my young friends really get the humor." But you did. Did you just pop out of the womb with, I don't know, a camera in your hand? I mean, you seem to be in love with the visual and cherish sound.
Yeah, well, what really gauged my interest is my parents are not film buffs, really. They were both, you know, they're smart people, and they you know, they knew the classics and they were around it, but they did not really bring me up that way, showing me stuff. I kind of came about it on my own. When I was very young, I learned when I was like, you know, a toddler, how to use my grandparents' record player at their house. And I was just would play 78s all day. And like, that was an early kind of, I've always been very into, you know, the mechanics of things and how these things work. And as I was growing up, you know, just going to, you know, flea markets and stuff, finding little 8mm rolls of film and finding projectors that would work and, you know, being able to make them work again. And just that kind of mechanical aspect was always super fascinating to me. And just as I learned about the history of these films, I started going back to the, you know, early days. I visited the Edison Museum over in Orange, New Jersey, and I saw the rooms where they, you know, show the original kinetoscope films. And I was totally transfixed seeing like wow, this is something from the 1800s, and it's actually, you know, moving it around. And I also, like, my elementary school was built in the 1890s, and maybe that, you know, had kind of locked in my brain, being like, wow, there's actually images from this time and a building I have to spend so much time in. Like, I think it all just kind of came together at the right time, and I just picked up a fascination for it.
Well, we are all fortunate to have you, I tell you, because you're cherishing something so wonderful we need to retain and preserve, and you are. So that trip to the Edison Museum, okay, that leaves us in line to talk about the Vitaphone.
Yeah, I mean, what was, yeah, just growing up, and especially like I mentioned, film form, there was this a man named Ron Hutchinson who was ran the Vitaphone Project, who is really the guy who is the reason we have so many of these great Vitaphone shorts and features, because a lot of them existed. They were sitting in archives at studios, but they're just kind of languishing. Most of them, you know, they were separated from their discs, so you would either just have a soundtrack or just a mute 35 millimeter print. Obviously, with Vitaphone, you need to join the two. But Ron was really the guy who would go to these places and find collectors and track down and marry these films together. And he would do yearly presentations at Film Forum, which I was a devout follower of. And every year there'd be a new discovery. You know, it's like, we found 15 seconds of this Technicolor short from 1930, and we're going to show it. You know, the real nitty-gritty stuff. But I was in love with all of it. And so that, from a very young age, I was able to see all these great films and, you know, hearing about the new discoveries. And because what's great about, you know, especially being into silent films, is that there's always new silent films because so many get rediscovered. So, you know, growing up, there was, I remember, they were doing during a presentation, they were discussing a Colleen Moore film called Why Be Good. Or no, it was Synthetic Sin, I think. But Ron had, you know, offhand mentioned that, oh, the film is lost. Too bad we can't see it. You know, the whole audience groans. They wish they could see it. And then someone, like, raised their hands, like, actually, I think I know where a copy might be. I'll talk to you in the lobby afterwards. And then, lo and behold, the next year, Synthetic Sin was playing at Film Forum. It hadn't played in 95 years. You know, discoveries like that, it's an exciting field. Like, I can't imagine, like, not how I was, you know, being a little kid watching that happen. It was just like, wow.
I love it. What a find. And as I read, Ron Hutchinson, he really saved this world. And
Definitely.
literally, they were searching in like yard sales, literally,
Yes.
for
Yeah,
these
I mean,
discs.
in attics, in basements. I remember there were a lot of treasure trove of films that were found in Australia because studios would ship films to Australia, and it was so expensive to ship them back, they just left them there. A lot of these films are hitting like the end of the supply chain. So, you know, all over, you know, these things, it's, you know, not all studios. It's a lot of chance and a lot of luck. But if you look in the right places, you know,
If you
it'll
look
work.
in the right places, I adore this. You know, it's interesting. There are so many changes in the world right now. I think we're at a real turning point where the world has shifted on its axis.
Yeah.
And in many ways, politically and otherwise. And I'm always trying to support the arts in any way that I can do with my meager little show. But it's interesting how the world turned when we went from completely silent with live music to the talkies. And
Yeah.
you know, the Vitaphone was really only used for a 2-year period, I understand.
Yeah, b 2 to 4 years, basically. It was a relatively short-lived process. Yeah, I mean, to go into more detail, like the very first shorts were being and produced in 1926, which was the series of shorts, and also the first feature, Don Juan, which was not a sound film but had a pre-recorded soundtrack, the Symphony Orchestra. And it basically, yeah, it lasted up to around, some theaters were still using the sound on disc technology into the early 30s, but yeah, relatively speaking, it was only a handful of years, a little more than two, but
It's
very short.
interesting. And then suddenly it was sound on film itself.
Yes.
And then away we go, you know?
Exactly.
It's interesting how, you know, that whole time period has been spoofed in films like Singing in the Rain. Of
Yeah.
course, you know, when everybody was trying to mic and it was so awkward in the beginning. But
Yeah.
Vitaphone had a really, really good idea. I mean,
Yes.
it's extraordinary, but it's extraordinary how things move so fast at that time.
Yeah, I mean, it's so many things were happening. Radio was a big reason the Vitaphone even came into existence is because for the first time in its history, basically, the motion picture had a serious rival, which was radio was coming into people's homes for free. So suddenly, if you wanted entertainment, you didn't necessarily have to leave the house.
Right.
And you could actually, you know, ticket sales were actually going down for the first time in film's history. So the producers in Hollywood knew that they needed something to up their game. And Sam Warner of the Warner Brothers was very smart and had Western Electric open a radio station at Warner Brothers so they could advertise their films on the air. But through that, Western Electric was able to pitch the idea of doing a synchronized sound process, which became Vitaphone, through that initial idea. But you know, when they signed that deal with Western Electric, it was not to create sound motion pictures. It was just to get more advertising.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And as I understand it, at that time, Warner Brothers was a minor studio, but boy, yeah, were they ambitious.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. The Warner Brothers had been working, you know, since the Nickelodeon days. They knew the business. They had been around for as long as the business had been around. And they had ideas, and it paid off in the end. It's pretty amazing how the company grew like that, especially in the late 1920s.
Exciting. So tell me more about your presentation on the 19th.
Yes, I'm very, very excited because this is, for me, it's an AV geek's dream come true. We'll be showing through Bob and Steve, who you mentioned earlier. They work at Warner Brothers, and they have figured out a way to show. We're going to be showing 35 millimeter prints of these Vitaphone shorts in conjunction with their actual 95 year old disc counterparts. And we're actually going to be syncing the real film and the real discs live, just as they would have done in the theater in the late 1920s. I don't think this has really been attempted since the technology became obsolete, you know, 90 years ago. So this is really going to be a treat. It's never been done. It's at least in my lifetime, not that I know of.
This is very exciting. It's going to be a great presentation for TCM.
Yes,
I mean, it's a really part of history, you know, when it comes to sound and film and the preservation of both. You know, mm-hmm. I find it very interesting that, you know, a few years ago when we could go and see Lord of the Rings at Radio City Music Hall or at Carnegie Hall with a full orchestra, live musicians, singers, choruses, the whole nine yards, the same thing with the extravaganza of Star Wars. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting how we're coming full circle. We're actually, you know, leaving sound on film for a minute and coming back to live music with the film broadcast, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's fascinating. There's a need for orchestras to lure audiences back into the seats. And for a person like myself who loves that marriage of film and sound, this is the ideal situation.
Absolutely.
And, so it's irony. I don't know where we're going to go next after this, but, you know, I'll wait and see. And I'm sure you'll have something to do with it, Shane. that's exciting. So tell me how the Vitaphone works. I mean, how did they make these discs?
The Vitaphone process in the studio, which actually coincidentally the first studio for Vitaphone opened here in Brooklyn, where I am right now, only a couple miles from here in Midwood, at the old Vitagraph Studios, where a lot of which had been very active since the early teens. Griffith worked there in the early teens, and because Brooklyn was closer to the Broadway stars than Los Angeles was, so it was much easier to film, get people who could, you know, have a voice and, you know, talent that needed sound. So,
yeah.
But what they would have is the performers on a stage with a microphone hanging overhead, and then the Vitaphone discs were very large. They were 16 inches in diameter.
Wow.
And they'd be cut. The bass would be a wax bass. And they would basically run a full reel of film, about 10 minutes, 1,000 feet of film, and run usually more than one camera in conjunction. Because you can edit film, but you can't physically edit a phonograph disc. You mm-hmm. basically just had to do everything in one take, basically. So what they developed was very similar to what eventually ended up being the sitcom multi-camera setup. They would have multiple cameras and soundproof booths, and they would be able to cut between the different angles without having to ever edit the sound. So the sound would stay the same, and the three cameras could capture different angles. So you could create an edited film and not just have, you know, just one static shot. That would be pretty boring. So they figured out a way to do that. And if that makes sense.
Wow. Wow. Well, it sounds very technical. I mean, and for
yes.
the time, it was mind-blowing. But
Definitely.
did I read, though, that the discs were so soft that after 20 usages, they would really be more ineffective?
Yes, and the studios wanted to keep, especially Warner Brothers, they wanted to keep Vitaphone, they want to keep its reputation intact. And if you, they didn't want worn out discs playing and people getting a bad idea of what these sound films were. And for our presentation, we're going to be playing these original discs, but what's different about what we have today versus what they had back then is nowadays the needle that we're actually going to put on the disc is very light, like even just a fraction of a penny weight, basically, playing these discs, which won't hurt them. But the original Vitaphone turntables, it's like 2 or 3 pounds of force with these heavy reproducers, because with the disc, you have to, the needle has to be amplified, and just the old amplifiers in the pickup were just very, very heavy. So they would, it was less that the disc was soft, but the tone arms were so heavy,
Nice.
It would just cut slowly into the discs.
Wow. So were
so,
they
yeah.
constantly reproducing these and putting them out to theaters and just making sure everything stayed fresh?
Yeah, I mean, it was a complicated, or it's one of the reasons the process didn't last that long, because there were a lot of steps. And as you can imagine, these discs were huge and they were made of shellac, so they were breakable. I can't imagine how many were destroyed in shipping. You know, they were, and like you see oft parodied in films like Singin' in the Rain, they had issues with synchronization because the
Right.
film and the disc are not joined together. They're separate.
Very interesting. You know,
Yeah.
you are an essential part of Silence, Please. And I love it when you and your counterparts speak about the peculiar, profound beauty of silent film.
Yeah.
What is it about silent film for you, Shane? And I know you come from the standpoint where you love Charlie Chaplin, you love the vaudeville, the action, the comedy. But I think one of your counterparts, Bill Morrison, said that it's dreamy.
Yeah.
There's something about silent film that captures our imagination like nothing else. What is it to you, Shane?
It's a lot of things, but I think that dreamlike atmosphere is sort of, it is what really rings true, is because without sound, you know, it's not, it's sort of separated from reality. You're just having these, I mean, films you can make, it's just more poetic, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, as smarmy as that's, not smarmy, as pretentious as that might sound, but, I just rewatched a film I love, Sunrise, The Song of Two Humans, F.W. Murnau's 1927 film. It's classic, but it's really so, it's really like a poem. It's not about plot. It's not about the dialogue between characters. It's just about expressions and the way the camera moves and the atmosphere. It's all about creating atmosphere and creating feelings, which I think is the most powerful element of all films. Great sound films have that same strength, but it's all about, the atmosphere is always going to be more interesting than, and, you know, just a plot. It's all about that, the feeling of it, you know.
But you also said, I think you said yourself, that it's always in the eyes. And
yes.
Somehow in silent film, everything is so exaggerated, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But the soulful eyes of a Greta Garbo.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it is when these performers were, had such a unique talent that it's so, the Vitaphone, you know, it's really a bittersweet thing, because it signified the end of all this artistry that was developed over the 30 years of the silent film, and just the acting and how, and, you know, there was that exaggerated style of acting, but it can be remarkably subtle, and just the way actors use, you know, like Garbo, like, and just every subtle movement is like, so, like, you know, the camera is such a magnifying glass, and seeing that on a big screen and just sitting there and watching it, it's very, very powerful.
It is a direct bridge into the soul, isn't it, Shane?
Absolutely. Yeah. The eyes are the gateway to the soul.
It, you know, as a musician, I look at this as very impressionistic. In
yes.
that atmosphere that you're talking about, it reminds me of the early John Ford films that he did, the war films that were just
yes.
alive with atmosphere. My
Yeah.
God, they were so unbelievable at the time. I mean,
Yeah. Four Sons, I believe that's my favorite. That's a beautiful, beautiful film.
Oh
I
my
think
gosh, yes.
yeah.
And how going forward, how are you going to preserve the art of the silent film and, of course, the marrying up with sound?
I mean, Me personally, I'm a film collector. Since I've also been that young age, I collect 16 millimeter film. I collect specifically a lot of silent films. I try to show them to as many people as possible. I've done screenings at all over the city, just kind of carrying my projector around like a traveling salesman. But I've been able to introduce a lot of these films to different younger crowds, and sometimes we've getting live accompaniment, or creating, if we can't get an accompanist, we can create a soundtrack that'll match the picture. And but I think the TCM does a great job of showing great silent films, and also in great quality, which is very important, because if you tell someone you should watch a silent film and they go off to YouTube and watch the first thing, it's probably not going to look that great. The soundtrack's probably not going to be very good. It might just be, generic, whatever. Yeah. Not a very dignified way to watch a silent film. But, by presenting these films, the way they were meant to be seen, in good photographic quality with great scores, that's going to create a legacy and people an intrigue with these films. That it takes just a little extra care with the silence to present them in the right way, and I think we just have to take that care, because once it's displayed that way, it's hard to look away. They're so enticing.
So well said. Well, my last question to you, because I know we have to wrap up here, is my signature question to all my guests. I'm going to just throw this at you, just like a 10-year-old sitting on Robert Osborne's sofa with him. If there is one word or phrase that you would use to sum up who you are from the depth of your heart, what would it be?
Wow, that's a great question. I'm going to have to think about this. And I don't want to be, let's see, what's a word that's not too self-aggrandizing and not too corny? Oh, God, that's a great question. But I'd say maybe, God, only one word. What's, I wish I had a dictionary and a thesaurus. But
what comes maybe, up to the surface first?
I would say this might be kind of silly, but celebratory. I like, I'm a collector. I gather a lot of old stuff, but it's not worth anything if you can't celebrate it and show it to people. It's no use sitting in a closet, hoarding it. It's all about, sharing and celebrating the stuff that doesn't get the spotlight anymore, I'd say.
Shane Fleming, that is absolutely perfect. What a way to end this interview, and what a joy to have you. And I've got to say, you are cherishing the art of the past, which is definitely the riches of today. So thank you so much. And I can't wait to be there on April 19th at TCM.
Can't wait to see you.
And I hope you won't be a stranger to Center Stage with Pamela Kuhn. Thank you so much for sharing and taking this time. You are one special person. Everyone, I want you to go to Turner Classic Movies for so much information that I can't give to you in this interview, but I'm glad to be a part of it. And I hope you'll also go to centerstagewithpamelakuhn.com for more interviews like this, and to save the arts in their form as we know it and preserve what's rich. Shane Fleming, thank you so much again. It was such a joy.
Thank you, Pamela.
And to everyone out there, stay safe. This is Pamela Kuhn, and the curtain is now down on Center Stage.